Hello and welcome to Novara Live. I'm Moy Lady McLean, and what a treat, because tonight I'm joined by Ash Sarkar.
They tried to keep us apart, Moya, but they will never succeed.
They tried, and what we did was start a podcast, which you can listen to if you go to If I Speak. Let's stick with what the task in hand, though. So coming up later tonight on Novara Live, child poverty has again hit record levels in the UK. This is becoming a pattern. We speak to experts about the issue and what needs to be done to solve it. Meanwhile, the Tory candidate for Mayor of Greater Manchester has defected to Reform UK today. And at the end of the show, we'll be speaking to Owen Jones about his defection from Labour and a new initiative he's announced to support left-wing candidates for Parliament. But let's go to our first story. The US has so far blocked every single Gaza ceasefire resolution proposed at the UN. It's now three times that the country has used its veto power against efforts to stop Israel's war there. But now, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been interviewed by a Saudi news channel, Al Arabiya, where he said this.
We actually have a resolution that we put forward right now that's before the United Nations Security Council that does call for an immediate ceasefire tied to the release of hostages. And we hope very much that countries will support that. I think that would send a strong message, a strong signal.
Very rich for them to start asking other countries to support their ceasefire resolutions. Now, Al Jazeera has obtained a copy of the text of that resolution, and it says this. The Security Council determines the imperative of an immediate and sustained ceasefire to protect civilians on all sides, allow for the delivery of essential humanitarian assistance, and alleviate humanitarian suffering, and towards that end, unequivocally supports ongoing international diplomatic efforts to secure such a ceasefire in connection with the release of all remaining hostages. Park life. Now, the language here is interesting. Yes, it contains the words immediate and sustained ceasefire, and that's what most of Western media is running with in their headlines. But these headlines are pretty misleading. What the draft text of the resolution actually asks the Security Council to recognise is the imperative of a ceasefire. In other, less mealy words, the US appears to be seeking formal recognition by the Security Council of the importance of an immediate and sustained ceasefire without actually demanding one. It's the appearance of doing something without actually doing anything, which the US are world leaders in. But Blinken's announcement comes at a time when the Biden administration is coming under increased domestic pressure to halt Israel's attacks on Gaza, yet Israel is showing no signs of letting up. Biden has repeatedly urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to call off his planned ground operation in Rafah, where more than two-thirds of Gaza's population are now crowded. In a briefing to the Knesset earlier this week, Netanyahu said this. We have a debate with the Americans over the need to enter Rafah, not over the need to eliminate Hamas, but over the need to enter Rafah. I made it as clear as possible to the president that we are determined to complete the elimination of these Hamas battalions in Rafah, and there is no way to do this without a ground incursion. International outrage has also been growing over impending famine in Gaza, with the entire territory now at risk of life-threatening food shortages. We shouldn't fool ourselves over the word impending because people are already dying of hunger in Gaza, and most of them are children. Reuters has this report on one child in northern Gaza, where UNICEF has said nearly one in three children under two suffer from acute malnutrition.
6-year-old Ferdia Zant is acutely malnourished. His spindly legs can no longer support him to walk. He is confined to a bed at the Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza, where famine is bearing down. Ferdi suffers from cystic fibrosis. This is him before the war with his twin, and dancing at a wedding. You didn't feel he was ill, his mother Shima says. He went to kindergarten with his brother like any other child. Then, she says, Ferdi was taking medicine that his family can no longer find, and eating a balanced diet, vegetables, fruits, and his favourite, grilled chicken. Ferdi's condition began to deteriorate about 2 months ago. He'd sometimes have 10 bouts of diarrhea a night. Before the war, he weighed 66 pounds. Now, his mother says, just 26.
If the war continues, his condition is getting worse. He is getting weaker. He keeps losing things. He can no longer walk. He can no longer stand. When I help him stand up, he falls straight away. He cannot hold himself.
Dying of hunger is one of the most torturous ways a human can pass away. I've recently been reading a book detailing the deaths of the 10 hunger strikers in 1981 in Ireland, and it is just living torture. And to see children dying like this when they could so easily be saved, I don't think words do it justice. Now, Fadi was being treated at the Kamal Adwan Hospital, where the Gazan Health Ministry says 27 children have died of malnutrition in recent weeks. But in southern Gaza, overcrowding and food shortages will also soon cause a rise in child mortality.
Here at the Al Auda Centre in Rafah, in the south, Umm Mesbah Hedji says her five-year-old daughter Isra suffers from quadriplegia, epilepsy, and now malnutrition. Her medication is no longer available, and she has lost a lot of weight. Displaced like nearly all Gazans, the family now lives in a camp with no work or money.
I die 1,000 times a day. I feel bad for her when I see her having spasms. There's no medication. She's hungry. I know she's hungry.
The ward nurse, Amira Abu Jawayad, says the hospital is unable to get enough milk for the children.
The situation is catastrophic. Every day it gets worse. The children here are suffering from malnutrition. We see it in a frightening way each day. We have 5 to 10 cases of children who have severe deficiency in nutrition, especially milk.
Now, that level of starvation is not going to disappear anytime soon. Because even if the bombing of Gaza were to stop today and food trucks were able to enter the strip, the dying would still continue for some time. This has been predicted on every level by experts, and yet it's been allowed to happen. The need for an immediate ceasefire has never been more urgent and grows more urgent with each day. Now, Ash, that resolution from the US, it is something, right? It is something.
Well, I think we should identify what that something is and then see if that is... my brain is just in full buffering mode. See if that is in any way meeting the extreme urgencies of this political and military moment. So what this draft resolution does is that it is an attempt by the US to wield diplomatic pressure in a public global forum in such a way that would hopefully shame Israel into calling off or scaling back any planned assault on Rafah. Now, there isn't anything to suggest that this approach is going to work with Netanyahu. He's proved himself time and time again to be a politician who is much more willing to push American goodwill a lot further than any previous Israeli leader of government before him. So trying to, you know, implement a draft resolution through the UN, which is largely toothless. It recognizes the urgent need for a ceasefire, doesn't quite call one, doesn't really put any options on the table for applying pressure directly to Israel in the form of sanctions or any sort of, you know, coordinated efforts with lots of other countries. So this is, it's just a bit of finger wagging, really. And what Netanyahu, I think, has consistently shown over the course of this entire war is that he prioritizes his own political survival over and above whatever it is Joe Biden might think of him personally. People in the White House know that Netanyahu is very difficult to work with politically. They're already trying to sideline him and work around him when it comes to their diplomatic overtures, having those meetings directly with Benny Gantz, for instance, just a few weeks ago. That shows that the White House considers Netanyahu not so much a geopolitical partner in Israel anymore, but a sort of thorn in the side that they've got to weather. Netanyahu's already priced that in. For him, the more dangerous political option is calling off the assault on Rafah, this war drawing to a close, and then suddenly he's under all that political pressure that we knew that he was under even before October the 7th. Very, very unpopular reforms to the Israeli Supreme Court. And there's also the matter of the security failures, which led to October 7th itself. What Netanyahu did when he set out the objectives for, it's not a war, it's a genocide that's being carried out. But what he did when he set out the objectives for what, in his view, is a legitimate war. Retrieval of the hostages was placed below the destruction of Hamas. Now, to what extent have Hamas been destroyed? I mean, yes, they will have lost much of their military capacity, but maybe not all that much. Their senior leadership remains intact. And secondly, it's a lot harder to fight urban warfare when instead of streets to send your soldiers and your tanks down, you've got to negotiate rubble. That tends to benefit insurgent guerrilla fighters much more than it benefits conventional armies. So this sort of objective of, okay, well, we've got to destroy Hamas, that's kind of indefinite and unachievable. So as long as Netanyahu is able to keep up this pretense of that's what the military objective is, he gets to stay in power. So all in all, I don't think that this draft UN resolution by the US, if it's not backed up by something like suspension of military aid, suspension of arms sales, I don't think it's going to have that much of an impact, because for Netanyahu, the end of the war means the end of his time in office.
Bombing, siege, and now starvation in Gaza. Well, these are the conditions that drive thousands of protesters onto the streets of Western capitals week after week. But the Israeli government believes that we're doing it for quite different reasons. Speaking at a press conference earlier this week, Israel's Minister for Diaspora Affairs and Combating Anti-Semitism, Amichai Tzchikili, said this about criticism of Israel.
The events of October 7 brought this attack to new heights of madness and hatred. We saw blatant support for the rape and murder of innocent men, women, and children, demonization of IDF soldiers and the Jewish state, linking them to the Nazis, distortion of the Holocaust and its memory, and the applications of hypocritical double standards tailored to specifically target one people and one state alone. The streets of Europe are once again unsafe for Jews, and many of its leaders, instead of showing courage, are demonstrating cowardice. Instead of standing with the truth, they align themselves with false Palestinian propaganda. Instead of supporting the victims of the attack, they side with the barbaric preparators. This moral laxity perhaps may serve short-term interest, allowing a temporary semblance of peace. But make no mistake, it will ultimately result in intensification and strengthening of radical Islam aggression and barbarism.
At a separate event in Jerusalem last night, Tzchikili said this about Britain. This is a center of Western civilization, the country of the Magna Carta, and one of the leading democracies of the West with a rich legacy of freedom of speech, of human rights. But it seems what is happening now in Britain is that freedom of speech no longer exists. Today in the UK, Jews are hiding their Jewishness, the mezuzah, the kippah. They know that if they speak Hebrew on the subway, they might get hit. And this is the reality for Jews in Europe. This is a reality in Europe where anti-Semitism is the worst since the 30s as a consequence of the Red-Green alliance with radical Islam. These inflammatory statements are pretty on form for Tzchikili. Last month, he compared Foreign Secretary David Cameron to Neville Chamberlain appeasing Hitler. That was after Cameron said the UK would recognise a Palestinian state after the war in Gaza. Tzchikili also said that labelled Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, quote, an anti-Semite for raising doubts about Israel's compliance with international law. Ash, we learned yesterday that Israeli spokesperson Alon Levy has reportedly been suspended for attacking David Cameron. Is Israel doing itself any favours via ministerial comments like this? Because Britain doesn't seem to like it very much when they turn on their allies.
I mean, this is exactly the kind of bullshit that Britain has itself enabled and empowered, because our government has tried to play this game of weaponizing anti-Semitism and weaponizing very real fears of racist harassment and attacks to clamp down on legitimate expressions of solidarity with Palestine, to demonize Muslims in particular in the UK and also the left more generally. So that's been the domestic political game that's being played here. Now, you can't get upset when The Israeli government plays that exact same game in order to exert political pressure on you. You simply can't get upset about that. So this is a beast which has been fed, watered, nurtured by David Cameron and his colleagues in Rishi Sunak's cabinet, quite frankly. When it comes to, you know, is this Israel shooting themselves in the foot? I think that, again, one of the things that this might result in is a sort of frostier diplomatic reception, perhaps a reluctance to provide so much diplomatic cover for the most egregious of Israeli abuses of Palestinians' political and human rights. But ultimately, when it comes to the stuff that matters, normalizing relations with Israel, sanctions, weapon sales, military aid, you know, you could call David Cameron Eva Braun and it's not actually going to change the disposition of the British government. It does, of course, make certain things more likely. So, for instance, the UK government potentially recognizing a state of Palestine or beginning that process in order to sort of, you know, spook whatever Israeli government is in power at that point into some degree of decency or somewhat better behavior. But the devil's in the detail. What recognition of a Palestinian state means doesn't necessarily equate to pressure on Israel to give up the occupation or to give back land which has been settled since 1967. It also doesn't necessarily mean that what kind of state the international community in the West will lend its support to for Palestine will be one which has any meaningful sovereignty. So once more, finger wagging, clutched pearls, nothing of substance.
Let's go on to our next story. Child poverty in Britain has hit a record high. We say that basically every year now. There are now more children living in poverty in Britain than at any time since comparable records began in 2002. According to government figures, 4.3 million children are now in relative poverty. That means they live in a household with an income less than 60% of the median after housing costs. And 3.6 million are in absolute poverty, up by 300,000 on last year's figures. According to the Financial Times, that represents the fastest rise in child poverty in 30 years. And it means that a quarter of all children in the UK are living in absolute poverty. So, what's driving this shocking fall in living standards of the nation's children? While campaigners point primarily to the two-child benefit cap, that's the Tory policy that means only the first two children in a family are entitled to universal credit or child tax credit, a sum amounting to around £3,000 per child per year. Any children born after the first two get absolutely nothing, diddly squat. The policy was introduced by Theresa May in 2017, though Labour have vowed to keep it if they win the election. So what's their plan to tackle the issue? Well, Shadow Employment Minister Alison McGovern told The Independent this. Labour will tackle the root causes of poverty by growing the economy, bringing down energy bills, creating better, more secure jobs, building more affordable housing, and protecting renters, delivering our child health action plan, placing young futures hubs in every community, cutting school uniform costs, and supporting parents and children by providing breakfast clubs in every primary school. That's called trickle-down economics, and we've known for 40 years that it doesn't work, and it isn't what poverty experts are asking for. Children's charities and campaigners are all calling for the two-child benefit cap to be scrapped, and they want a social guarantee for those families most in need, covering basic costs like food and household bills. The effect of Britain's dire economic policies is hitting children hard, so hard that now schools are having to fill some of their basic needs. Desperate neglect is how an Observer report describes the situation, with teachers having to wash children's clothes and even find them beds as a result of deepening poverty. That article goes on to report this. The head of a primary school in a deprived area in northwest England, speaking anonymously to avoid identifying vulnerable children, said, "We have a child who we put in the shower a couple of times a week." He described the family's bathroom as disgusting and said they couldn't afford to buy cleaning products. His school routinely washed uniforms for children whose families didn't have a washing machine. The report continues. The school recently stepped in to help after discovering a pupil begging outside a supermarket, and its free breakfast club was really needed. But lack of sleep has also become a big symptom of poverty and a barrier to learning. We've got a lot of kids in homes with not enough beds or a mum sleeping with one, with two or three children, the head said. Support staff would often take children out of class who weren't coping because of exhaustion to let them sleep for an hour or two. Some children are falling asleep in lessons and not just little ones, he said. One teacher described children vaping and drinking energy drinks to suppress their hunger, leading to erratic behaviour and poor or no learning. Another said that some of their students had no beds of their own, while others had no bedding or heating, meaning the cold kept them awake. One head teacher put the situation like this. There is this simplistic, romantic idea that education lifts people out of poverty, but you have to do something to mitigate the impacts of poverty or children can't learn. The former Children's Commissioner, Anne Longfield, blamed the government's decade-long assault on public services for the alarming rise in child poverty. And she described schools as, quote, the last people standing in terms of support for kids from poor households. Earlier today, I spoke to Jo Lane, Director of Policy at Action for Children, about the record figures.
It's just more evidence that child poverty is too high in the UK. And what we've seen really is lots of hand-wringing over how poverty is measured. So, you know, we often see in Parliament that they debate the difference between relative poverty, absolute poverty. And what today's figures have shown actually is now, you know, however you look at poverty, those figures are going up. And Action for Children is a children's charity. One of the things that we often point to is that however you measure poverty, however you cut that data, whether you're looking at relative poverty, absolute poverty, food insecurity, being behind on bills, other types of financial hardship, it's always children and families with children who are the most likely group to be growing up in poverty. So it's very easy for politicians of all parties to say, you know, children are the most vulnerable and they're deserving of the most help. But at the moment, we don't have the policies, we don't have the strategy to make sure we're protecting children from poverty and bringing that, you know, horrendous high level of child poverty down.
Obviously, as you say, this is a reflection of a lack of strategy and a lack of long-term policy. Have we seen any initiatives within the current economic landscape that have successfully helped alleviate child poverty in certain communities? And can they be scaled up?
There's a few things there. So one thing that we have talked a lot about at Action for Children, we try to really shine a light on, is this idea of work being the best route out of poverty. So, you know, we constantly hear that in political messaging, but we know statistically that the vast majority of children who grow up in poverty live in households where their parents are working. We've dug into that data in granular detail and shown that around half and two-thirds of children growing up in poverty in the UK live in what we call sort of work-constrained households. So that means their parents would really, really struggle to do any more work than they already are. And that might be because they're working full-time. It might be because one of them's working full-time and one of them is looking after a baby, or one of them is disabled and unable to work, or one of them is, you know, has caring responsibilities for a disabled family member. So using really, really, you know, being quite sort of strict almost with that criteria. So that's probably an underestimate of those people who would actually really, really struggle to do additional work. So it's one thing we say to all political parties at the moment is it's not enough to just say, you know, work is the best route out of poverty. It's clear that families are working as much as they can and their children are still, you know, suffering with growing up in poverty and all of the impacts that has. Actually, in terms of measures that work, we had that sort of strange instance during the pandemic where universal credit went up by £20 a week. And actually what we saw in that period was the headline child poverty rates fell. And then that uplift was scrapped. And then you had, you know, a very real sort of natural experiment almost where child poverty levels have rebounded straight away because of that policy choice to get rid of that £20 uplift. And our sort of headline recommendation to the government and to all political parties going into the general election is the best way to get money in the pockets of low-income families is to invest in the child element of universal credit. So for every pound you invest in the child element of universal credit, that gives you your best bang for your buck in terms of lifting children out of poverty and, you know, in the most cost-effective way.
We're most likely to see a Labour government come 2025. They have said they will be keeping policies like the two-child benefit cap. What would you want to lobby a Labour government for in order to end child poverty in the UK?
One really encouraging thing is that the Labour Party going into the election have committed to a child poverty strategy, and that's something which is absolutely essential. But we know from this parliament that, you know, just having that commitment to, you know, for instance, in the 2019 manifesto, there was that commitment to use in the Conservative manifesto, the commitment to use the social security system to reduce child poverty. Clearly, the statistics that have been published today show that that hasn't happened. So at Action for Children, we'll be working, you know, making sure that all political parties have a really clear commitment to reduce child poverty after the next general election. And then after the next general election, on those specific changes that are needed to do that. So some of those are about the social security system. We want to see, you know, that investment in the child element of universal credit. We want to see the two-child limit, the two-child benefit cap scrapped. We want to see the benefit cap scrapped to make sure that people who need that money can benefit from it, that the benefits they receive aren't artificially capped. And then also that work that needs to go on in the labour market. So when we talk about work-constrained households, our employers, you know, creating the jobs and creating the labour market conditions that enable those people who have real lives, you know, lives where they have childcare responsibilities, care responsibilities, outside of their family, where they might have their own needs, whether that's disability or other things, and that those people are able to work as much as they can, and they're able to do that in a sustainable way, and, you know, in jobs that don't sort of make their health conditions worse or their lives unbearable. So also that work around the labour market and making that work for families, and, you know, those two things together make the social security system adequate, target money at families with children in particular, and make the labour market work better for those people who need that flexibility, will go a long way to reducing the level of child poverty in the UK.
Where is the political will to deal with child poverty in the country? Because surely you think our politicians wouldn't want to see the country return to Dickensian levels of poverty. And yet that's exactly the situation that's been described.
One of the big challenges in sort of combating child poverty is, on the surface, you know, all politicians of all stripes, all colours say they want to reduce child poverty and want to see as few children growing up in poverty as possible. There's, you know, there's endless reasons to do that. There's obviously your sort of moral and ethical reasons that, you know, we want all children to have a positive life experience, to be able to flourish and fulfil their potential and, you know, have as many choices in their lives as possible. And then there's also those, you know, more what people would see as sort of hard-headed reasons, but in terms of the costs that child poverty imposes on the state, in terms of the costs it imposes on the economy, the knock-on health impacts, the knock-on impact on school outcomes and labour market outcomes. So there's plenty of reasons and plenty of sort of superficial will and Action for Children, you know, we campaign really, really hard on this every year, and, you know, and we'll be doing the same in the run-up to the general election. It's not enough to just say we want to reduce child poverty. We need to make those policy choices that target spending in whatever sort of fiscal environment there is, but that there's spending choices that can be made but target that spending at those families and the children who need that money the most.
I understand you also have a report today out on child exploitation. How does that link in with the figures that we've seen today?
We heard hours and hours and hundreds of thousands of words of evidence from experts and people with lived experience of child criminal exploitation. And, you know, within that, there's a whole host of risks that pose, vulnerabilities to children, to families. And that's, you know, the areas they live in. It's, children, often black boys, but certainly black and minority ethnic children overrepresented in those figures. But absolutely what we hear is that children living with financial pressure, where their families are in financial difficulty and the cost of living crisis has only made that worse, that's a vulnerability for exploitation, because those criminals often organise crime. They know that children, and particularly sort of children as they get a bit older, they're looking to get a bit of money themselves. They might be looking to help out in terms of the costs with their family. And that's something that they can use to groom and exploit those vulnerabilities. So absolutely, you know, when I talked about the knock-on impacts of poverty on other areas of the state, it makes children vulnerable to exploitation. And, you know, our evidence shows that this is in the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of children who are being groomed and exploited and certainly are vulnerable to exploitation. And the harm of that almost can't be overstated. And, you know, we heard as we produced our report for today, that lived experience of children who've been threatened, who've been sexually abused, you know, children who Action for Children have worked with, who've been killed. And, you know, these children are not being protected at the moment, and they're being made more vulnerable often by the financial situation, but, you know, but where they are growing up in financial hardship.
Let's go to our next story. Now, Labour's race relations advisor has accused Keir Starmer of not listening in a new speech. According to reporting from The Times, Doreen Lawrence, mother of murdered teenager Stephen Lawrence, privately criticised the Labour leader during a closed meeting of majority ethnic minority MPs and peers on Tuesday. Attendees also included Sue Gray, Starmer's chief of staff, and Shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy. Lawrence is reported to have said this: "I was appointed as the race advisor, but I haven't been listened to. I wish Keir listened to me. There are gatekeepers who stop things from happening." The Times report continues. Lawrence added that she no longer knew how to respond to complaints about the party leadership from Black and minority ethnic voters, and questioned its decision to scale back a conference at which Starmer had been due to unveil plans for new race equality legislation last month. When approached by The Times about the leaks, Lawrence didn't deny the remarks had been made. Instead, she said this: "Of course, I'm always going to push the party to do more, as the fight for equality is never done. But I've known Keir for years, and I've no doubts about his commitments to equality and fighting racism. That's why I've been proud to work with Labour to develop their plans for a new Race Equality Act." As The Times report points out, Lawrence made these remarks in the midst of renewed questions about MP Diane Abbott's suspension. Abbott is the longest serving Black MP in Parliament, and she's also currently suspended from Labour because of remarks she made in 2023 saying people belong to Jewish, Irish and GRT communities only experience prejudice, not racism. But last week, it was revealed that Abbott had been the target of violent, racist and misogynistic abuse from the Conservatives' biggest donor, Frank Hester. In the wake of that scandal, Abbott has publicly asked for the whip to be restored and said that Labour also needs to address racism in its own ranks. According to the Times report, Abbott's case was discussed at the meeting Doreen Lawrence spoke at. So was Kate Osamers, the Labour MP suspended in January for including Gaza in a list of genocides she cited in a newsletter on Holocaust Memorial Day. According to sources present, there were complaints about how slowly the party is conducting disciplinary cases against politicians from visible minorities who are seen to be part of the, quote, Corbynite left. Now, what these disciplinary processes actually entail is a bit of a mystery. Keir Starmer and his deputy, Angela Rayner, have publicly said the investigation into Abbott specifically is an independent process. But there are conflicting reports as to whether Abbott's suspension is actually being handled by Labour's chief whip instead, which would make it an internal process and not independent. The whip can also override independent decisions. For example, in 2020, Jeremy Corbyn was readmitted to the Labour Party by an independent NEC panel after being suspended for rejecting some of the findings of an EHRC report into anti-Semitism in the party. Allies said that that should have meant automatic reinstatement as a Labour MP. But the whip was still withheld from him, and he was barred from standing at the next election, despite the findings of the independent NEC panel. Now, multiple sources are now saying that Labour is seeking a similar outcome in Abbott's case. Journalists Andrew Fisher and Lee Harpin have both reported that Labour leadership have offered to restore the whip to Abbott if she stands down at the next election. Ash, is it true that ethnic minority voters and MPs are getting the short end of the stick with the current iteration of Labour?
Yes, but I assume you want me to say more than just yes.
Is it all ethnic minority MPs and voters, or is it certain parts of the party is what I'm interested in?
I would say it has a lot to do with race, but it's not entirely to do with race, particularly when you look at the treatment of Black, Asian and minority ethnic MPs within the Labour Party. So effectively, what you have is a highly politicised disciplinary process. Now, if you cast your mind back to the EHRC report, that's exactly what Jeremy Corbyn was accused of presiding over and was the reason why the EHRC felt compelled to intervene. Now, you've got, if anything, an even worse disciplinary process now for MPs, where it's ultimately up to the discretion of the party leadership as to whether an apology is going to suffice to bring someone back into the fold. Now, what that means for ethnic minority MPs who are on the left of the party is that disciplinary mechanisms, particularly when it comes to accusations of racism, and especially when it comes to accusations of anti-Semitism, will be used as a pretext, no matter how flimsy, in order to suspend the whip. And then if it comes to, you know, booting someone out of the party for good, you could say, all right, well, it's not for anti-Semitism. Instead, it's for bringing the party into disrepute or something else. It's all a way of giving what is effectively a factional process a veneer of moral legitimacy. Now, that does have an impact, I think, on all ethnic minority voters in this country. Because when you see the party, which is likely to form the next government, basically saying, okay, racism is one big political game to us, and we'll notice it when it benefits us and we'll ignore it when it doesn't, that doesn't mean you can trust these people in government. I mean, remember when during the Black Lives Matter protests, you had Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner taking the knee and sort of gazing vacantly in the middle of an empty conference room. You know, you had these commitments to implementing the recommendations of the Lammy Review, Angiolini, the Windrush Report. You can't trust these people to do what they say, because the next moment when it's not politically convenient, or they are coming under pressure from right-wing newspapers or the right of their own party, they will, as they've shown with their own internal processes, absolutely do what's best for them and their political careers rather than doing what's morally right. So yes, ethnic minority voters and ethnic minority MPs are being shafted, but they're being shafted as part of a specific political attack on the left. And this is, I think, an important point to make, which is that when you see this kind of factional warfare on the left of the Labour Party, it is actually screwing over and marginalising all ethnic minority voters and would-be politicians in this country.
God, remember when all the politicians were taking the knee? My word, what a time that was. Obviously now you cannot give a better example of gesture politics than those empty shots of people taking the knee amid the pandemic, masks on. And now we fast forward to today. God, wow. That will be in an Adam Curtis documentary, won't it? Let's go to our next story. A big blow to the Tories today because their candidate for the mayor of Greater Manchester has just announced his defection. Dan Barker was previously running for the Conservatives against Labour incumbent Andy Burnham, but today he jumped ship to Reform UK, the party formerly known as the Brexit Party. This is what he told the BBC about his defection. I think, in truth, the Conservative Party have given up on Greater Manchester and the north of England. You can see that from inside the party. What they are really doing is trying to protect the blue wall in the southeast and the southwest because they fear that the Liberal Democrats are going to annihilate them. When are we going to get rid of the term wall? It's becoming the gate of politics. No more walls, no more gates, no more suffixes like that. For their part, the Conservatives had pretty sharp words for Barker. An anonymous Conservative parliamentary candidate told Politics Home that, I congratulate Dan on going from being guaranteed to lose because of his mediocrity to being doubly guaranteed to lose because of his untrustworthiness. These are the same people who selected Barker as their mayoral champion in December 2023. You have to ask, did they have such faith in him then? It's quite fascinating because the Conservatives have always been held together by their lust for power, and now they're just absolutely falling apart. Now, Barker's is not the first defection to Reform. He, of course, follows Lee Anderson, the former deputy chairman of the Tory party. Anderson was suspended from the Conservatives after making Islamophobic remarks about London Mayor Sadiq Khan. He then coincidentally decided his heart really lay with Reform. And if polling is to be believed, lots of Tory voters may feel the same. The latest YouGov polling has given Reform 15% of the projected vote share in a general election. But look at what the Tories are on, just 19%. Labour are currently sitting on 44% of the vote. Of course, these polls are untested, and in the most recent parliamentary by-election in Rochdale, Reform came sixth with only 6.3% of the vote. So it really does remain to be seen if this polling is something that actually translates to results, and it hasn't happened so far. But that hasn't stopped the media making noise. And what I want to know, Ash, is all this furore about Reform, right? Do they pose an actual tangible risk to the Tories, or are they just acting as this pressure group?
I think it can be a bit of both. While Reform is eating into the Conservative Party vote share, at least in, you know, Westminster voting intention polls, they have an ability to spook the Conservative Party into adopting its political positions, its rhetoric, and to empower those on the hard right of the Conservative Party when it comes to eventually launching a leadership bid. So you've got that element where they can operate as a pressure group. And because basically they've got billionaire funders with endlessly deep pockets, they can afford to sort of chuck a few candidates at the wall and see what sticks in a general election. If they end up with candidates in parliament, and I'm not just talking about, you know, defectors like Lee Anderson, he's on course to lose his seat in Ashfield, I believe it is. But if they end up with, you know, one or two candidates, that's an incredible bully pulpit for them. So I think that they can afford to be both. I think that Reform is already very different from the Brexit Party in that they've ruled out the possibility of any deals with the Conservative Party. Basically, there is no policy position that the Conservatives could say that they would adopt because they're not going to form the next government. And so that's not going to form the basis of any kind of agreement to stand down in particular seats. And yeah, they can afford to see what happens next. What I'd say is that the approach of Reform so far has been quite scattergun. One is that they're obviously fighting an air war with the help of GB News. Two, they're absorbing defectors like Lee Anderson and other candidates running locally and regionally. But, you know, Lee Anderson was going to lose his seat anyway. Many of those candidates didn't have a snowball's chance in hell. So thinking about how all this is going to add up after the next general election, there is a big old question mark. I would say that on balance, it looks like what they're trying to do is prime the political terrain to ensure that there is a further rightwards drift in the Conservative Party.
Okay, let's go on to our final story. Left-wing journalist Owen Jones has made headlines today, literally, and is trending on many social media platforms by announcing that he's leaving the Labour Party after 24 years.
I've always been a Labour guy. My family's been Labour for generations. I joined the party at the age of 15 and I voted for them under every single leader in the 21 years of my adult life. But for me, the party's over and I've just quit. And now I think it's time for us to vote Green or Independent, unless you've still got a Labour MP who offers an actual alternative to the catastrophic Tory policies which have brought this country to the edge of ruin. The Tories are toast. You can send Labour a message without risking them sneaking back in. Now, they'll try and spook you into thinking, despite the Tories having comprehensively nuked themselves, you've got to vote Labour, or you'll just let the Tories back in. Don't believe them. They're just after a big majority, so they've got absolute power and they can do anything they want and no one can stop them. You can't trust them with that power. Look how they keep purging their opponents, boasting of blackmailing the Speaker of the House of Commons to overturn parliamentary protocols to get their own way. Look, personally, I'm scared of what they'll do with the power that a whopping big majority will give them. If we don't get our act together, when it all ends in tears for Starmer's Labour, and when they're in government, believe me, it will. The far right will be waiting in the wings instead. The Tories are toast. We deserve better. End the war on hope. Send Labour a message. Let's do this.
Right, so didn't want to just give Owen a free advert for his campaign. We have actually asked him some pretty hard-hitting questions when earlier today I caught up with him about this new campaign, We Deserve Better.
I, for a long time, I've been thinking of ending the increasingly toxic relationship I have with the Labour Party. But I spoke to various people and they thought if I was going to leave, then I might as well do something with it. And lots of them were thinking about the idea of, you know, how do you build pressure on the Labour Party in the electoral system that we have, given the pressure that's coming on it which it very willingly embraces, is pressure from the right. And what came up in those conversations is, why not something which raises money for independent candidates, Green Party candidates, as well as, if they'll take the money or allow to take the money without being kicked out of the Labour Party, Labour candidates who still stand for things like taxing the rich to invest in public services, public ownership, and not slaughtering thousands of innocent people in Palestine. And from that came the idea of, we deserve better. So it's not my campaign. I'm not a leader. I can barely tie my shoelaces. So that's probably not a good idea. But that's bringing together lots of activists from across the movement, including councillors who've left the Labour Party, peace activists, climate activists. So, for example, William Fatima from a Green New Deal Rising is involved. They're already doing their own strategizing to raise money and resources for candidates like Jamie Driscoll in the Northeast, the former Labour current mayor who Labour banned from standing for the new Northeast Combined Authority. And the idea of it is, at the moment, people think, look, not happy about Labour, but what do we do now? And this is trying to say, look, there are Green candidates who stand for things like public ownership, taxing the rich, taking on the climate emergency, there are independent candidates organically coming out of communities, and there are still good people on the Labour Party. You don't have to choose.
You've spoken a bit today. Actually, I'll ask you a different question first. What was your red line when it came to your lifelong support of Labour and deciding to leave the party?
Israel's genocide in Gaza, no question. What that did is turn what I think is a Labour leadership, which got there through dishonesty. Keir Starmer clearly made a series of extremely dishonest commitments, from public ownership to taxing the rich, investing in public services, scrapping tuition fees. We really could go on. It's quite a long list. In order to, you know, accept things like continuity, austerity, slash and burn cuts, which have led this country to disaster, as well as, I don't know, take child poverty, for example. These New Labour had policies on tackling the crisis of child poverty. It wasn't enough, but the minimum wage was something, tax credits were something. These people support the two child benefit cap, which drives 250,000 kids into poverty and 850,000 children further into poverty. So they don't even have that compared to Blue Labour. That's bad enough. But what takes what I think is a disgrace on domestic policy into abject moral disgrace is the fact at the very beginning, Keir Starmer said he supported the right of Israel to cut off water and energy to a civilian population, then sent shadow ministers on television to back that morally depraved position. And I think that position is sick, by the way. He's a human rights lawyer who understands the Geneva Convention. He knows what Article 33 says on collective punishment. I told Emily Thornby, my local MP at the time, that I wasn't going to vote for her. That was back in October. So clearly I've been thinking about this for a while. I wouldn't be able to do that. I think war crimes, collective, supporting what at the beginning was clear from the genocidal statements of Israeli leaders. I called them genocidal on the 9th of October, 2 days after this horror began. I think it was very clear what was going to happen. I don't think I'm a prophet. I don't think I had extreme special insight. I just listened to what Israeli leaders said, and they followed to the letter what they said they were going to do. Labour backed that. They legitimised it, and they're unfit for office. Of course I can't support something like that. I think it would be, you know, grotesque.
You said you're not in charge of this new campaign, but do you know if there's going to be any similar red lines in the politicians that will be allocated funds from this war chest? You know, for example, independents like George Galloway, very pro-Palestine, preaches an economically redistributive agenda, but also on the flip side, use like an extensive amount of transphobic language in the campaign materials he was giving out. Like, where are the red lines going to be when we're dealing with these new independent candidates, some of who really mix up what political ideologies they follow?
It's not just transphobia on the part of George Galloway, is it? It's on a whole range of issues. I mean, discuss it, talking about refugees being men of fighting age, his language around grooming gangs. When he attacks the Scottish First Minister, Hunza Yousaf, in a tweet, he said, "You're not Scottish like me, you're not Celtic like me." What are you supposed to do with that kind of language? He claims the 2020, he suggested, you know, he's open to the idea of the 2020 presidential election being rigged by the Democrats. You should condemn Joe Biden for supporting genocide and war crimes. Doesn't mean you give in to Trumpian conspiracy theories about the 2020 election. And also, for talking about foreign policy in terms of consistency, I very much opposed any Western military involvement in Syria. That doesn't mean that I turned a blind eye to the horrors unleashed by Assad against Muslim innocent civilians. So I think consistency on human rights internationally and not giving in to bigoted views about minorities, trans people, I think is a very striking example. So yeah, I think the red line, I don't think it's a, you know, it's not easy to come up with these. It's not a problem or difficult to come up with these red lines. Consistency, which is you stand always against prejudice, against all minorities, you stand up for all minorities, irrespective, and you consistently stand for human rights at home and abroad. You know, I don't think George Galloway's left wing, I know it's going to annoy some people listening to this, but taking a good stand on Gaza, which he has, doesn't in any way, you know, compensate for his views elsewhere, which is why I think this is important, because we need, you know, independent candidates who are rooted in their community. And at the moment, Galloway's filled that vacuum, hasn't it? He's there because there isn't something like this to help support and fund independent candidates. So I'm hoping, you know, we'll have people, for example, who used to be in the Labour Party, like Jamie Driscoll, and also Leanne Mohammed, who's a British Palestinian woman who's standing against Wes Streeting in Ilford. Andrew Feinstein, who's standing against Keir Starmer himself, who's a former ANC politician and the son of Holocaust survivors. So I think it's not, it's very straightforward to come up with those red lines.
But has that been agreed to by the coalition behind We Deserve Better? Has that already been discussed as something that will be stuck to when allocating these funds?
Yes, absolutely. That's something which those who have been involved have all discussed and agreed. You know, there's a huge range of independent and green candidates they're going to be backing. I mean, an obvious one is when Jeremy Corbyn ends up standing, which I think is very likely. He hasn't announced it, but I'd be extremely surprised if he doesn't, given local party members in Islington North have been denied their democratic rights by the party leadership, their right to choose their candidate, and they would overwhelmingly choose Jeremy Corbyn. You know, Diane Abbott, if she's not allowed to stand, you know, she's someone who should be supported if she went on to become an independent candidate if the Labour Party refused to allow local members in Hattie North and Stoke Newington to vote for there. So it's not, you know, there's no shortage of these candidates. So I think there's a whole range of them, but the coalition would immediately fall apart if Galloway-ites, George Galloway-type candidates were backed. Of course, you know, the Green Party wouldn't be involved in something like that for a start. I think it's important to have that consistency.
This isn't quite tactical voting, it's more like tactical funding, but you've still been hit by lots of accusations today that you're essentially helping the Tories with this. How do you respond to those?
There is more chance of one of my cats becoming supreme emperor of the universe than the Conservatives winning the next general election. It's not going to happen. The Tories have destroyed themselves. They've felt self-immolated. Just one of the scandals, I suppose, scandals, euphemistic, that they've been embroiled in would be sufficient to finish off a normal political party, Partygate being one, the worst squeeze in living standards on record, collapsing National Health Service and general public realm, just being in power for that long, being intellectually and politically exhausted because they've gone through so many iterations and every single one has failed. But obviously, for me, you know, what clearly destroyed the Conservatives was the Liz Truss experiment. People didn't like her policies. They objected to them overwhelmingly. And they objectionable policies crashed the economy and sent rents and mortgages spiking. And after that, the electorate decided it doesn't matter what you say or do. We're not listening and we're not going to vote for you anymore. That was the end of the Conservative rule, which is why now in the latest poll, they're looking like they're going to get overtaken by reform. Even if they claw back some support, given an election is likely in either October or November, in fact, inevitable in October, November, and we're now in March, there is no way in hell they could possibly win. And you're right, if this was a close-run election, I don't think something like this would be seen as possible because too many people would go, ooh, look, Owen, people of my perspective, see where you're coming from. Don't like these guys either. But we've got to get the Conservatives out. So the reassurance, the tagline of a campaign is, the Tories are toast. Let's send Labour a message. If you vote Green or Independent, you're not going to let the Conservatives win another term in office. There's absolutely no chance for that happening. And the really fundamental point is, you are going to be spooked into thinking that by Labour and their client journalists, but they don't believe it. The reason they're saying it is because they want the absolute power of an overwhelming majority. And you've seen how they behave with a dissent in their own party. They have very cynically and factionally used, for example, the issues of racism, where they protect those who support Keir Starmer, who make anti-Semitic remarks, and then cynically, for example, purge the likes of left-wing Kate Osamor, one of the only black female Labour MPs, for saying what's happening in Gaza is genocide on the day the International Court of Justice puts Israel on trial for alleged genocide. We saw what they did to the Speaker the other week. Their own people certainly briefed BBC Newsnight's political editor that the Speaker had crushed the SNP's collective punishment, its motion saying Israel was responsible for collective punishment, because he'd been told that the Labour wouldn't let him become Speaker again if they get a majority, which they will. You can't trust them with that power. These people are power mad. They're authoritarian. They're intolerant of dissent. And the only reason they're trying to spook people into thinking the Tories will win, which they absolutely know there was no chance of happening whatsoever, is because they just crave a massive majority. And believe you me, they will use that majority to use this machinery of state for factional revenge. That's the sort of people they are. They will clamp down on the right to protest. They will find ways of using the state to come down hard on anything associated with the left.
5 years ago, we were pleading with various centre-right figures to stop writing op-eds about why they were leaving the Labour Party and why Jeremy Corbyn and his front bench were the worst things that could ever possibly happen to this country. Is We Deserve Better a continuation of that cycle from faction to faction, or is it an attempt to break it?
I think the very clear difference is those on the right of the Labour Party are, I think, the most effective cry bullies in British political history, in that they spent years going, oh, Jeremy Corbyn's the next coming of Stalin. Look how totalitarian and tolerant he is. He's crushing us. He did no such thing. Obviously, he started with the shadow cabinet packed full of people who opposed him, and then they resigned en masse. And then he continually appointed people from the whole length and breadth of the Labour Party, including Keir Starmer, who was the shadow Brexit secretary. So he put people in place who he knew didn't support him from all wings of the Labour Party. Now, I think a lot of people would say he was too lenient. I think in hindsight, that's what people would argue, wouldn't they? He didn't purge a single MP. Not a single MP got deselected as Jeremy Corbyn. You had for months, I remember because I had to keep going on television about it, a national news story, which is seen as like a national scandal, about a few councillors getting deselected in Haringey. So the point I'm making is there was no reign of terror under Jeremy Corbyn. Actually, it was a broad church, and they were allowed to constantly attack and brief him with no action of any description taken against them. This, on the other hand, is the most authoritarian leadership in the history of the Labour Party. Don't listen to me. Listen to John Cruddas, who is a MP from the middle of the party who used to be an advisor to Tony Blair. And he said this is the most illiberal faction in the Labour Party's history in charge. And they're on a power. They're also, you know, they have the most authoritarian leadership in history. So I think the point I'm making is I've supported Labour in the past when they've done terrible things. People completely correctly just go, well, why are you backing Labour then under X, Y, or Z then when they're doing terrible things? Because the difference is now, firstly, the nature of the crisis enveloping Britain in terms of austerity, they're going to continue that. That, in my view, means the far right are going to stand to benefit. So unless we do something now, given Labour are going to continue those policies, the far right will end up benefiting. So we have to do it whether we like it or not. That's my own view. But the other is there's no way back as things stand without external pressure. If people think Labour might change in the future, which is, I think, still a legitimate perspective, it'll only happen with external pressure. Otherwise, they will just purge everybody on the left, which is what they're doing. They're making a hostile environment for anyone to the left of Peter Mandelson.
Where can people find out more about We Deserve Better?
Go to wedeservebetter.uk. And it's really simple at the moment. What you do is you donate whatever money you want, you can. And there's a cost of living crisis. It's only if people can. And that money will then go to the likes of Leanne Mohammed, who's standing in Ilford against Wes Streeting, the shadow health secretary who boasts of how he's going to increase privatisation of the National Health Service. Or it will go to, for example, Carla Denyer, brilliant Green candidate, standing against Thangam Debonair in Bristol Central, with polling suggesting she could win, well, with more funding. I'm sure that makes it more likely. Jamie Driscoll, former Labour mayor of North Tyne, now standing for the North East Combined Authority. His election's in May. He needs all the support he can get. So all you do is you just either donate, if you can, at the very least, put in your details. Because the other part of this is to get people to go in if they're nearby, put in your details, and then people can be sent information about how you can campaign, how you can, you know, give up some time, knock on doors if you're able to do so. It's really simple at the moment, you know, and I think, you know, we'll see what happens when Star Wars in power. I see this as a trial run myself. It's laying foundations. It's limited in terms of what you can achieve with an election so close. But there's all these brilliant candidates now, and you don't have to choose between the Green Party or the Independents. You can just give some money and it will be apportioned to candidates. You won't agree with them on everything, but you'll agree with them a lot more than you agree with the Labour leadership. And it'll put pressure on Labour. We've already seen Wes Streeting, obviously quite spooked by the support Liam Mohammed's getting, and that's why he started changing his rhetoric on Gaza. It'll scare them and it'll put pressure on them. And it just, you know, if it's just £2 or £3, it makes a difference and it'll go to candidates who need it. And as I say, either you put pressure on them or the hard right of British politics will keep putting pressure on them and Labour will gladly keep shifting towards them. It's up to us.
Wow, we have some super chats. Rob Hogg, £5. Owen is right. Labour is now morally and politically bankrupt. We do deserve better. And Jason Stewart with £1.99 says, can we see more of the cat, please? Pay up. Musa costs more than that. If you wanna see Musa, you gotta throw the cash around.
He's currently just out of shot glaring at me because he's like, it is my dinner time. And here you are talking into a screen at nobody instead of giving me my munchies. He's glaring at me.
£10. He said, I'm working at the pyramids tonight. I need £10. Ash, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And it's great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me and see you all again next week.
Thank you to everyone who tuned in. Remember, if you watch live, you get to see bloopers occasionally, which is great fun. And to the person who asked if I have ADHD, I have got a clinical diagnosis. Tune in tomorrow for another stream at 6 p.m. You have been watching Novara Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Novara Media. Go to novaramedia.com/support.